Have you ever left the movie theater feeling this twinge of sad disappointment? And I'm not talking about like when you go see Fast and Furious 6 or Twilight or something like that. That's normal. That should happen. But something like when you see a really good movie and you walk out of the movie theater into the bright light of an afternoon in the parking lot and you just feel maybe a sense of discontentment. Or the same can work with a book. Have you ever lifted your eyes from a book and felt reluctant to go back to real life? Maybe when you're a kid reading Chronicles of Narnia, and you got called back from Narnia, and you go to peek in your closet anyway just to see if there might be an opening back there. It happened with me recently reading Lord of the Rings for the first time. Yeah. It's great. And it's like I don't care that I'm a skinny bookworm because I just wanted to be there. It's like, just give me a sword and I'll take a swing at that orc. The best stories, they have a capacity to stir us in the deep parts, the deepest yearnings and longings we have that rarely seem to correspond or fit with real life. The Lord of the Rings tapped into some deep yearning I have for adventure that I don't experience in the day-to-day. The best stories, they engross us in that other world, and sometimes they make coming back to the real world a little bit difficult, and feeling like you have a background discontentment. Coming back to the mundane or the messy patterns of everyday life can be hard, and maybe it's romance stories for you. Maybe it's those stories that stir you the most and leave you to feeling disappointed the most. And maybe reading through the Song of Solomon has felt a bit like that for some of us. Like, this is beautiful and everything, but in our world of sexual brokenness and dissatisfaction relationally, is it really possible? Is unquenchable passion in the context of being unconditionally accepted even something that I should hope for? Is this some just unattainable, pie in the sky ideal? I think the Bible in our passage tonight is going to address these questions for us. And so if you would, turn with me to the Song of Solomon, chapter 7. We're going to be skipping chapter 6 and about the first three-fourths of chapter 7. It's probably one of the most erotic passages in the book that we're skipping, but we feel like we've traveled that ground sufficiently, and so we wanted to fit in some other topics into the semester, but you can read it on your own if you'd like. The passage we're going to be reading tonight, chapter 7, verses 11 to chapter 8, verse 7, is thought by some to be the climax of the entire song, especially the latter part of it. And so, let's read together, starting in chapter 7, verse 11. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened, and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. How about that? The big idea I'm going to use to guide our time tonight is this. Because love only flourishes in the context of covenant faithfulness, we should cultivate romances of passionate exclusivity. Because love only flourishes in the context of covenant faithfulness, we should cultivate romances of passionate exclusivity. So love, only context where it flourishes is covenant faithfulness. That is, the deepest romantic yearnings you feel are only realized in the context of radical oneness. The type of oneness God speaks of in Genesis 2, and the man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That's radical oneness. And because of this Song of Solomon type love, because it only comes in that context, all our romance should be about making that happen. That's what we need to cultivate and fight for, and we're going to talk about three ways to think about that or to do that. You do it by pursuing with persistence, by yearning with patience, and by committing with permanence. Some of what we're going to be talking about tonight pertains especially to married life, but it's going to filter to our level too. What you think about marriage is going to change a lot about how you go about relationships now. And a marriage of covenant faithfulness later depends on a commitment to passionate exclusivity now in where we are, real life. So first, we should pursue with persistence. The last three verses of chapter 7, verses 11, 12, and 13, they tell about this woman's pursuit of her man, and what a pursuit it is. She's checked the calendar, she's gotten out the dates, she's marked it off, she's talked to her husband's coworkers to see if he can get off of work early. And she has prepared this whole weekend retreat out in the countryside for them to enjoy together. And why is she pursuing her husband like this? And why is it important for us to know that covenant faithfulness, this oneness, it requires persistent pursuit? It's because relationships require continual work. We've seen this throughout the song already. As amazing as their romance has been, it hasn't been perfect, right? As intense as their passion has been, it hasn't been constant. So the same woman who in chapter 2, verse 5 says, I am sick with love, and she yearns to consummate the marriage with this man. In chapter 5, when he comes to be intimate with her, she says, I've already taken my dress off. How can I put it back on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? When the passion of self-giving love leaves the room, selfishness sneaks in the doorway. And this is what she's talking about in chapter 2 when she tells her man, catch the little foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards. The vineyards uses a picture of their relationship throughout the song, and it's a good picture. Not only because vineyards are beautiful and they produce lots of fruit, but because they need a lot of upkeep, right? Because sometimes little foxes sneak under the fence and eat up all the fruit. And you have to take care of the foxes. Her pursuit of him in this passage is like saying, I don't want those foxes in the vineyard. We need to gather up all this fruit, so let's go tend to it. If you've been in a relationship for more than 2 weeks, you know that this is true. You know that things that seem cute quickly become annoying, and that you need to start work really soon. infatuation doesn't last that long. Because most things that don't get worked on, they either become nasty or dead. So you need to put wood on the fire. You need to weed out your garden, and you need to dust your room if you're type A. Relationships are the same thing. Left without upkeep, they're going to either turn nasty or just die. So here's a question. Who should pursue with persistence in the marriage relationship? Both husband and wife should. Up to this point in the song, all right, we're almost seven chapters in. She has been the pursued one. In chapter one, it's implicit that he has begun this relationship. He's been the initiator. He's taken her. She's been the shy one and the pursued one. Chapter four comes along. He comes with his party and takes her to the wedding, and they consummate the marriage. Chapters 6 and 7 is mostly like this long monologue where he's just talking to her, and then it ends up with another exchange of intimacy. And this is how it should be. Men, you should take the initiative. You should take a step out and risk rejection. It should start with your pursuit, men. But notice now that she's the one taking the initiative in their lovemaking, in their marital intimacy. And what initiative is? She's created this like virtual oasis out in the middle of nowhere for him so that they can enjoy each other together. And it's a beautiful thing. The reason it's beautiful is because she's not trying to manhandle him and be the leader in the relationship. She's lovingly and selflessly responding to his pursuit of her. And in so doing, she's helping to cultivate their covenant faithfulness, their oneness. In Proverbs 5, the writer, he tells this to men. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be always intoxicated in her love. When this woman plans a weekend retreat for her husband, she's saying, I'm going to help you do that. It's her way of clearing out the foxes in their relationship and fostering passionate exclusivity. She's also displaying the biblical reality that marriage implies mutual ownership. Okay, so in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul, writing a letter to the Corinthians, they're having some marital issues in there, and he says, wives, you do not have authority over your own body, but your husband does. Likewise, husbands, you do not have authority over your own body, but your wife does. He's saying that there are going to be moments when a wife wants to be intimate with her husband and he's not feeling it, even though we usually think about that the other way around. In those times, Paul says, don't deprive her. You don't belong to yourself anymore, husband. You are one with your wife now. And notice, too, what it looks like to pursue with persistence. It looks like selfless service. Her attitude in this section is totally opposite what we were thinking about and looking at last week when she rejects her husband's advances. Instead of doing that, she's creating an environment that she knows he's going to love. So she's been listening throughout the song to everything he's been saying, just as we have. And she's noticed, you know, this guy talks a lot about fruit and flowers. It's like he says, I'm a garden fountain. Says, I'm a lily of the valley, a rose of Sharon. My cheeks are like pomegranates. My lips drip nectar. I'll take them where there's fruit and flowers. So she's been studying, and she serves selflessly. And, of course, the real fruit and flower is her. And she gives herself to him. That's the one he wants. The takeaway here is this. Don't think that dating ends at marriage. It doesn't. If we think of dating in the sense of pursuit, it's not some premarital stage that you do to win somebody over and then it's like, yes, cha-ching. Covenant faithfulness doesn't happen without pursuit, beginning with a man's and reciprocated by a woman's for a lifetime. We sometimes talk about it as if it does end at marriage or as if it ends when a gal agrees to go on a date with a guy, but it's not true. It ends when you die. As much as we might not like it, satisfying those deep yearnings for love, it's really hard work. It requires a lifetime of pursuit. If you're in a relationship right now, don't be surprised that it's hard work. The Bible says it will be. They sometimes don't show that in the movies. Second, we should cultivate romances of passionate exclusivity, covenant faithfulness, by yearning with patience. A new section of the poem begins in chapter 8. And she begins by saying, "Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breasts." Okay, there's some cultural context here we need to get at real quick. Because in our context, if a girl says, "You're like a brother to me," the romance is over. Not what's going on here. Even though we don't have specific information about this, it seems to be the case that in ancient Israel, lovers expressing acts of affection toward each other wasn't welcome in the public square. There were no PDAs in Israel. But that it would have been okay for a brother and sister to greet each other with a kiss. And so she's saying, "I want this public, I want this unashamed love with my man." And then she goes on to say this. She did find him out in public. She lead him and take him to her mother's house, she who used to teach her. And again, it might seem odd to us that she would choose to take him to her mom's house, especially given that it's clear she wants to be intimate with him. But here's what I think she's saying. The ideal parent-child relationship in Israel was one where parents would pass along every piece of needed wisdom and practice to their kids. So we can think of Deuteronomy 6 when God says that parents are to commit all of God's commandments to their children. The parent-child relationship was supposed to last all the way till marriage. A man shall leave his father and mother and shall hold fast to his wife, and the two will be one flesh. And so what I think she's saying here is that her mom has just schooled her, taught her in the art of romance. And now she's wanting to put it into practice. The final two verses of the section, verses 3 and 4, they continue the sense of longing. She imagines the two of them together, his left hand under her head and his right hand embracing her. And then for the third time in the song, she gives the warning to the daughters of Jerusalem, "I adjure you that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." These four verses in chapter 8, it could be like a flashback to before when they weren't married yet, or maybe it's just a time in their marriage when for the moment they can't be with each other. But either way, it's filled with a sense of longing, of yearning to be intimate with her man and for the moment not being able to do so. But even though yearning, it's the tenor of the passage, there's a deep longing here. She's doing it patiently. Even though she seems pretty carried away at the end of verse 3, she is able to recognize and recommend the need to wait. And here's why I believe she yearns with patience and why we should too. God is not holding out on you or her. This woman had an unquenchable passion. That is true. She had an unquenchable passion that she wanted to let loose. And she wanted badly to express it. But her unquenchable passion was met with a commitment to this like uncompromised purity. And she's committed to uncompromised purity, I think, because she believes that God isn't holding out on her. This woman is part of the people of Israel. And God gave Israel boundaries for sexual practice. And especially in that statement where she is telling the daughters of Jerusalem, "Don't stir up or awaken love until it pleases." I believe she's saying that she believes God's boundaries for sexual practice are good. She believes that God's commands around sex are like guardrails that keep you on the road to joy, not like a straitjacket that keeps you from fulfillment. She thinks that God's ways are not only righteous, God's ways are good. And that obeying them is the way to tap into that reservoir of deep romantic yearning. Psalm 84:11, "No good thing does God withhold from those who walk uprightly." No good thing does God withhold from those who walk uprightly. That's a promise. So do you believe it? Do you believe, Christian, that God isn't going to withhold anything good from you? That God's your perfect father and that Jesus really did come to give the abundant life? We can see from the passage that it doesn't always mean getting everything you want in the moment, all right? It's not health, wealth, prosperity. It doesn't mean that God fulfills your romantic yearnings right away or even soon. Sometimes he didn't for this woman in our passage. What it means is that whether God fulfills your desire or not, he's good, and it's for your good. Because he doesn't withhold anything good from those who walk uprightly and cling to Jesus. So God isn't holding out on you, no matter where you are, just as he wasn't holding out on her. And so she yearned, but with a patience and a trust in the promise that God's ways are perfect. So when you ask a girl out and she says no, or when you want a guy to ask you out and he doesn't, or when it doesn't seem like there's anybody in the picture that you could be with, or when you break up with somebody, or when somebody breaks up with you, or when you're filled with romantic or sexual desire and you yearn for a righteous outlet, in all of it, without exception, if you're a Christian here tonight, God's working it together for good. He's not holding out on you. For God, who did not spare his own son, how will he not also, with Jesus, graciously give you all things? God didn't spare his most precious treasure in order to save you. He's not going to withhold any good thing. So don't fear to desire what God has said is good. Don't fear to desire strongly what God has said is good. It is good to want to be married. It is good to want to have sex. God says so. Unless you have the gift of celibacy, he has hardwired those desires in you. So you don't have to fear desiring strongly for what God says is good, but do it with patience, trusting his timing. Believe that your times are in his hand. And that your romance, it doesn't have to fit into some artificial timeline that you got from who knows where. Yearn with patience. Don't stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Don't try to force something that's not right for the moment. Instead, trust that God, whose eye is on the sparrow, is also watching you and working all things together for your good as you hold fast to Christ. Get the promises of God's goodness under your skin. And bring all of your yearnings under the lordship and the provision of Christ, your Savior. And as you do so, you'll prepare yourself for a passionate exclusivity when the time's right. And third, we should cultivate romances of passionate exclusivity by committing with permanence. Imagine that reading through the Song of Solomon, it's like walking up this mountain that has a bunch of different streams running down it. And as we've studied through each passage, it's kind of been walking next to these streams, taking your shoes off, getting your feet wet, smelling the flowers and foliage beside each stream. Verses 6 and 7 is like getting to the top of a mountain, the mountain, and seeing the fountain that is bursting forth all those streams. If you want to know why the streams are like they are, you go to the fountain. If you want to know why this couple has been talking about love like they have and acting on it as they have, you need to look at verses 6 and 7 of chapter 8. Her description in verse 5 there, it comes after another intimate encounter that she describes by awakening him under the apple tree, which is this symbol of intimacy. And she associates the experience with his birth, just as his life underneath the protection of his parents began under this apple tree, it seems so new life with her is going to begin there. And then there's this transition. So I can picture her becoming quiet and thoughtful, but with this burning intensity in her eyes. And she looks at him, says, "Set me as a seal upon your heart. As a seal upon your arm." for love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. So here we see why we should be prepared to commit with permanence. Because mutual ownership is God's design for marriage. When you get married, everything you have and are belongs to another person. And everything they are and have belongs to you. This is what she's getting at when she says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. In her day, a seal would have been like a stamp that you put it on something and it has like an inscription or a picture on it that says, this belongs to this person. She's saying, put me as a seal on your heart and arm. Let me own you. Let the world see that you belong to me, that you are mine, and let it see that you own me and that we belong to each other. This doesn't necessarily fit very well in a world where individualism rules the day, but it's what the Bible means when it talks about one flesh. And the reason it's so important to uphold this reality of radical oneness is because it's really a picture of the gospel. We've talked repeatedly throughout the series that human love, all human love, what we're reading in the Song of Solomon, it's just a picture, it's an echo, it's a whisper, it is a shadow pointing to the substance that is the love of Jesus for his people. Jesus is a bridegroom who came to earth to win his bride. He came to a bunch of sinners who deserved only his judgment, and he decided to make them his bride. And here are the terms of the marriage. You want to be a part of the bride of Christ, you have to cast all of your sin on Jesus and receive from him all of his perfection, all of his goodness and righteousness. You must consent to those terms. Everything you are is his, and everything he is yours. Imagine that a king decides to take a peasant woman who is just riddled with debt. He takes her to himself in marriage. In that moment, he is both giving of himself and all of his resources to her. Even as he is taking on all that she is and all of her debts to him. And we are riddled with that burden of sin that we might compare that to. And Jesus is like that king who decides to take us. He comes to us with the abundance of his grace and a free gift of righteousness. And he says, only believe. He says, and you will be mine. Only stop playing the adulteress and find your satisfaction in me as your husband. Only believe that my resources are enough to completely pay your debt and that my glory is enough to completely thrill your heart. And you will be mine. Paul uses the language of a seal in Ephesians when he says that we have been, Christians have been sealed with the promised Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Christ himself. If you're a Christian tonight, if you have accepted the terms of the marriage by trusting in Jesus for forgiveness and cleansing, Jesus is a seal upon your heart. He's a seal upon your arm. You belong to him. And he's committed himself to you in covenant faithfulness forever. So in your human love, be prepared to commit with permanence because mutual ownership is God's design for marriage. Another reason for why we should commit with permanence is because it's the only context where the fire of love can blaze with strength and safety. Love is a ferocious power. stronger than death, fierce as the grave, flashes of fire that are the very flame of the Lord, can't be drowned, can't be bought. Love is a ferocious power. I mean, she's just bringing up all the mightiest forces she can think of and saying, I can match that. My love can match that. The fire of love, this fire is meant to blaze on the hearth or in the fireplace of covenant faithfulness, of passionate exclusivity. Just like a hearth is for the fire, so covenant faithfulness is for love. Pursuing love outside this context is like trying to light the carpet on fire to get warm. It makes sense why she says, don't awaken it. Don't awaken love until it pleases, because it will burn your house down if you don't have a fireplace to put it in. Get this. Saving love for covenant faithfulness for one person whom you will live and die with, it does not diminish the power or pleasure of it in the slightest. According to the passage, the exact opposite is true. Saving love for this context is the only way to keep its power and pleasure and to satisfy those deep yearnings. And last, as we come to a close, here's how you do it. Here is how you commit with permanence or prepare right now to do so later. You be renewed in the image of God. You imitate God. If we were reading this song apart from the rest of the Bible, we might walk away thinking that she's a little crazy. Love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. A lot of guys with their girlfriends say that to them, they just run away. It sounds a little extreme, doesn't it? It would, if God didn't talk the same way. And if God didn't say that we should reflect him. You know where this woman learned to talk like this? She learned it from her God. She's been listening to her God. The one who says in Isaiah, I've engraved you on the palms of my hands. The one who in Deuteronomy, Moses describes as saying, our God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. The one who Paul, centuries later, would say, has the strength of a love that is not as strong as death, but stronger than death, fiercer than the grave. Nothing can separate you from it. Neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation. This isn't the crazy talk of some love-drunk woman. It's a bride who is reflecting her God. The Bible says that we are made in the image of God, and we were made to reflect his perfect character. And that our affections and our passions and our longings, they only find fulfillment when we are acting in that role as image bearer. But we're broken images. We've all failed to reflect God's glory. And instead we reflect other stuff. Instead of our love reflecting the covenant faithfulness of our God, it images divorce and adultery, sexual abuse and selfishness. This is why our inward longings so rarely correspond to reality. Because they only correspond to reality when we are imaging God and we're poor images. But the Song of Solomon is in the middle of God's story of redemption. God's story of how he is making us into new creations through the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. So that we grow to image him in everything we do. The Song of Solomon isn't this book out in a void. It's a picture of love in the context of God's redemption. This is a picture of what love is looks like when it is being redeemed. Not perfect love, it's not. But a love that is progressively growing to image God. The couple's covenant faithfulness is the result of knowing the God of covenant faithfulness. They can image God because as a part of God's people, they've experienced the wonder of redemption. The wonder of the reality that broken things don't have to stay broken. That corrupted hearts don't have to stay corrupted. But that God can reach in and make healing happen. Ironically, Song of Solomon type love isn't possible if you make a God out of love. It's only possible if you make a God out of the God of love, the God and Father of Jesus Christ. If you make him your greatest desire and hope and stop trying to find meaning and fulfillment in other things. Imaging forth God's faithfulness, the covenant faithfulness in our human love, it requires redemption. It requires God reaching into your life and making you a new creation through what Jesus has accomplished for you. And then it requires living out that redemption day after day after day. There's no 10-step program to imaging God. There's only a lifelong process of walking in the reality of your redemption more and more. So the great application from this, then, is clear. If you're not a Christian here tonight, and a love of covenant faithfulness is what you want, get to know Jesus, the God of covenant faithfulness. You need to turn from making a God out of other things and refusing to image forth the real God, and you need to love him. You need to know redemption that comes through faith in the good news that all your sin can be paid for through Jesus' death and all his perfection given to you in return, if you only believe. And if you're a Christian here tonight and covenant faithfulness is what you want, then you need to sink deep into the glory of redemption. You need to love Jesus and everything that he is for you because of the gospel. You need to relish this gospel and this God of redemption until your heart sings. You need to do it every day. Because as you do, you will grow in your ability to pursue with persistence, to yearn with patience, and someday to commit with permanence. And in that fireplace, that hearth of covenant faithfulness, Your love, it's gonna blaze with the fire of passionate exclusivity. It'll be the very flame of the Lord.